Does the rise of AI mean that there will be more or fewer software engineers in the future? Chris Hay is a distinguished engineer and CTO for customer transformation. Chris, welcome to the show. What do you think?
A billion software engineers by 2027.
Wow, 2027. Okay. Shobhit Varshney is a senior partner consulting on AI for US, Canada, and Latin America. Shobhit, what's your thought?
Everybody will go from becoming a programmer to being a pro at grammar.
I will ask you to explain that more in just a moment. Kautar El Megrawi is a principal research scientist and manager at the AI Hardware Center. Kautar, welcome. What do you think?
I think it's going to be a different breed of software engineers that we will be seeing.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings you the analysis, debate, and banter that you need to stay ahead of the biggest developments in artificial intelligence. Today, we're going to cover agents for cybersecurity and the launch of SearchGPT. But first, let's talk about software engineering. There's a fascinating blog post that came out from GitHub the other week, basically reporting out some data that from their perch. GitHub's reporting that there appears to be a rising number of developers, driven largely by tools like Copilot. And second, they also point out that Python's incredibly becoming a really, really popular language, driven largely by data science and machine learning applications. And this is super interesting to me, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up as our first story of the day, which is, had you asked me, I would have said, look, where code assistance is going, we're going to eventually just replace all the software engineers. There's going to be no more software engineers in about a decade. And maybe, Chris, I'll toss it to you first, because your prediction is that, if anything, we're going to have way, way more software engineers in, I think, 2027, right? So literally like 24 months from now. Why do you think that?
I think it for two reasons. Number one is, with code assistants being everywhere and with things like ChatGPT, large language models, pretty much in the everyday person's hands, everybody can become a coder. So you don't need to go and pay money to go and get somebody to do that. You can literally have a go yourself. And I think that is just going to open up this sort of democratization of coding that we've all kind of hoped for. And I think more tools will come in, like you remember Scratch from kind of MIT. Then I think we're going to see more of that style side of things, and everybody is going to become a coder. The other one is, you didn't say in your question, Tim, whether they had to be humans, did you? So the carbons and the silicons, and there's going to be a whole bunch of silicon coders to match us carbons. So when I multiply that up by 2027, there's going to be a billion, buddy.
Okay. All right. That's really interesting. Yeah, I guess kind of what we're talking a little bit about is almost like that the question is whether or not like the job coder, or the category code engine, software engineer, is really going to make sense in the future. Like, it almost feels like no one's like, oh, I'm a word processor, right? Like, kind of everybody knows how to write. Shobhit, I know your response seemed to kind of suggest that you think some of the skills you'll need are going to have to change.
Yes, absolutely. I think all of us will become pro at writing good grammar and the way you ask a question and how you describe what you want to get done. A good technical PM does a really good job at explaining what exactly they need, so that the developers can go and execute the code to the vision of what the PM had, right? So I think that's going to shift quite a bit. Let me just spend a minute on just appreciating how far GitHub has come. You just referred to their annual report that talks about the GitHub, all the numbers. Last week, we were at their big GitHub Universe event, and this is where we, as IBM, sponsored that as well. Just to give you a sense of how far they have come, GitHub is the world's biggest repository. Like 90% plus of all Fortune companies use it, 98% developers. We're at about, 100 million developers plus on GitHub today, Chris? Not quite at the billion that you want there to be. But in the last like 9-10 years, now it's 10th year they've been running this, they've had close to 70 million GitHub issues people have solved, almost 200 GitHub pulls, like 300 million plus projects and whatnot, right? The way I look at it, open source is the biggest team sport on earth. It's not soccer, it's not football, it's open source as the biggest team sport, right? It has been crazy growing. So when you hear from Tom, the CEO of GitHub, they're giving you actual stats of what they're seeing with people developing more and more. And he's very right to say that AI, the threshold of creating code for AI, engaging with GitHub repositories and trying it out, downloading it, contributing back to it, IBM has been a big proponent of having a very open community. We've had a really good relationship with GitHub. And now that the GitHub is opening up quite a bit, it has Claude models and Google models that can be leveraged in addition to all the OpenAI models. I think this is just an unstoppable force right now in the industry. And more programmers will have access to tools that we just could not imagine we had a couple of years back.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things in the report that they did was also that it seems like the geography of software engineering is changing, right? That there's like a lot more coders from, they're seeing from the global south come online on GitHub. I guess, Shobha, do you think that's related to code assistants? Or I'm kind of curious about how you see like the role of these assistants in even potentially kind of like broadening like the geographic scope of who gets to be a software engineer.
Yes, so I spend a lot of time with Latin America clients as well in Americas. And I see a lot of centers developing where all of a sudden the threshold of being able to have economic benefit in the region has just plummeted. So people can go create code and go contribute to other locations in other countries. And increasingly so, a lot of my clients are starting to build their Latin American presence. The time zone helps in the US as well, but just the access to tools and being able to create in every language, right? Now I have an opportunity to know Portuguese in Chile and be able to code and get some assistance in Portuguese while I'm creating code, right? That did not exist earlier. So the barriers have come down significantly and you see a higher threshold. This is one additional thing I would add to this. We should also look at the way energy movements happen across the world, right? If you look at countries like Chile or Latin America, there's a lot of energy that's being created there, and you want the AI models to be trained closer to where there's energy. Because energy consumption is going to be so much, I would anticipate more pull towards Latin America or centers where there's energy production in surplus. It used to take a lot to move that energy from Latin America to, say, serve customers in the US. Now the AI models will be created closer to where the energy sources are.
Kautar, I want to kind of turn to you is, you know, building on what Shobha just talked a little bit about is that, you know, I think when you responded to the opening question, you said, well, it's going to be more about like asking the right questions. And I think that's like one interesting item here to kind of pull on, one thread to pull on is, maybe actually in the future, it's actually we're going to have a lot more technical PMs than we really will have software engineers, because it feels like the role that people are increasingly having is they're kind of managing this agent that does the coding, not really doing software engineering themselves. And I guess kind of I'm curious if like the right way to think about this actually is we're going to just have a lot more PMs in the future.
Yeah, I see. Of course, you know, the skills will be changing, shifting. And this, for example, Copilot, what it's doing is demystifying coding for people without formal training. Turning more people into kind of citizen developers. So this means that professionals from diverse fields, such as data analysis, design, finance, healthcare, etc., can now use code to build custom tools without extensive studying or training or syntax, etc. And this kind of heading towards a world where basic coding becomes as common as using spreadsheets or even presentation software. So just learning, it's kind of, they're trying to be prompt engineers also, but specifically designing good prompts for software engineering. So I think it's also time to start reimagining what's the right developer workflows here. For experienced coders, AI can handle repetitive tasks, letting them focus on higher order problem solving, for example. And this might alter the skills expected in software development with coding transitioning more from syntax-heavy work to strategic thinking and architectural design. So I think those really would be good skills to start acquiring, not really focusing on the syntax, but more on how do you build systems, how do you design systems, how do you put them together, and then using the co-pilots to help do the syntax work. I think this also could have implications even for education. Right now, curriculums, they focus a lot on syntax. And so if AI can assist with coding, should really educational systems shift from focusing on syntax to broader problem solving or even collaborative design? Especially as Shobit mentioned, open source, it is actually the biggest team sport right now. So I think acquiring those skills, how do you collaborate, you know, do all of these things, do PRs and learn how to work in a team, going to become a really important skills in the future. So I think the traditional computer science curriculum really need to adapt, emphasizing creativity, ethical coding practices, advanced debugging and also collaborative coding.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, Chris, I mean, it kind of puts a tough question to you. I mean, your title is Distinguished Engineer. So you spent a lot of time getting really good at the software stuff, right? But I think if a kid approached me today and say, should I be a software engineer? Should I just tell them not to? Like, it kind of feels like where we're headed is like, is there any more value in actually learning how to code anymore? Right. I think it's the question I want to put to you.
No, they should go and play soccer ball or something like that.
You know, really? Just, okay.
Yeah. No, I think. So I think the question I would say is what happens when it goes wrong, right? So if we really think about the history of software programming, right, it's you're kind of back in the kind of the punch cards and the ones and zeros, and then the assembly language came across, and then, you know, and then C, I mean, there was a whole bunch of other languages, Fortran, et cetera, but then it really kind of took off, I would say, from the kind of C onwards, which is very close to assembly language. And then the abstractions got higher up, and now we're at Python, et cetera. And then, you know, we've now got Rust, blah, blah, blah. So the number of languages are increasing, but it's abstraction layer after abstraction layer after abstraction layer. We've went from hardcore kind of punch cards to assembly to low-level languages to garbage-collected languages to higher-level languages, blah, blah, blah. And again, all I would say that's happening here is we're moving to another level of abstraction. And that level of abstraction is natural language. I think it will be better because with agents, we'll have tools, etc. But you're still going to want to know the fundamentals, because what happens when you get a bug and it can't fix it? Are you going to be like the Homer Simpson? You're just going to be hitting the keyboard and going, try again, try again, try again. Or are you going to have to go, oh my God, I'm going to have to use my brain. How dare you make me use my brain? So I think the fundamentals are still going to be there. I see this becoming a higher level of abstraction. Now, don't get me wrong. If the models become good enough at some point, then there may be a different abstraction where models may have their more native language, et cetera. And that's a whole different discussion. But I think I see this as an abstraction because we need explainability. We need the reasoning. Somebody's going to have to maintain this and look at it. And you can't be fully dependent on the AI. I do want to address one thing, though, Tim. On that GitHub report, Python, I mean, we mentioned Python there being...
Yeah, we didn't talk about that aspect all that much, so yeah.
Yeah, Python being the most popular language. I just want to point out one thing, right? And I love all languages. I love Python, but when number 2 and 3 are TypeScript and JavaScript, which are effectively the same language, my friends, and more JavaScript-like people are becoming TypeScript people, you know... If you add the two things together, who's number one again?
I mean, yeah, I had the same reaction. I mean, I am a Python diehard, but I do feel like that was a little bit funny in the counting.
If I might add, I think there are also some risks here. There are potential risks for AI-created code, especially as more code is generated by AI. Quality control becomes a concern here. How do we ensure AI-generated code is secure, efficient, maintainable? So there is also the risk of over-reliance on tools like Copilot, which could lead to a drop in fundamental coding skills among, you know, the new programmers. So, of course, you know, there are lots of advantages here in terms of democratizing, having more developers, lowering the bar of entry and things like that. But we shouldn't also ignore the risks that will come with this, especially around quality assurance, control, ethical considerations, security, and also when things fail. So can we ensure that we have skilled programmers or people like Chris Hay mentioned that know how to bug and figure out what's going wrong, or we will have less skilled people in those fields? So what's the right balance here?
Yeah, I think it's always going to be this tricky balance between kind of, you know, democratizing, making it accessible, making it usable, and then kind of like the reliance on these abstractions. My mom, who was like a coder when she was before her retirement, has a story about like in her early days, like carrying a bunch of punch cards to the computer and then like dropping the punch cards everywhere. And it basically like, and her having a good enough sense of the program to basically reassemble the program, like physically by the cards. And I was like, that is like a level of diligence that like modern engineers just would not be able to accomplish. So, but obviously we are happy that we've moved past the punch card era for sure. Thank you. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. There was a great and very interesting story that kind of follows on, I would say, a sequence of stories we've had on MOE for the last few weeks, which is thinking a little bit about the application of AI and specifically kind of agents to the computer security space. So Google did a blog post from their security project, Project Zero, that basically reported that they have a cybersecurity agent called Big Sleep. That was able to find a vulnerability in SQLite, which, if you're not familiar, is one of the most widely used kind of database engines out there. And this is a really interesting story because, at least by their accounting, this is kind of one of the first instances in which an agent was able to find sort of a genuine vulnerability in the wild in a code base that is kind of like widely used. And so in some ways, it's almost kind of like a real kind of hello world demonstration that we might one day be able to use these agents for identifying real world vulnerabilities and making our systems safer. And so I guess maybe, Chris, I'll kick it to you to kind of kick us off on this topic. But, you know, I think the first thing I think a little bit about is this the beginning of just kind of a new era? Like, we will just start to see agents play a bigger and bigger role in making systems more robust? Or is this still kind of in the realm you think of, like, the toy project, right? Like, we're still going to be a few years off before we live in that world.
No, I think we're already in that world. And there's a couple of things about the Big Sleep thing. I mean, the first thing is, if you give agents access to tools and then you get them to follow patterns, then the agents are going to do a pretty good job. So if you think of cybersecurity, you know, go fix me this bug, go identify this pattern, go find me what ports are opening on a firewall. These are all things that agents can do today. Now, if we look at the Big Sleep one, and I do want to caution this, because when I read the paper there, the thing that they did is they took an existing vulnerability that existed on that code base, and then they got the agent to go search the PRs and say, hey, go find me another vulnerability of this style that matches this pattern that wouldn't have been patched yet. And then it went and found that. So as much as it's like, by my understanding, as much as the agent discovered a vulnerability on its own, at the same time, it's kind of pattern matching and was prompted and directed to go and find a bug of that similarity. And that is completely within today's technology. You know, agents and models are really good at pattern matching. And if you give them access to a large enough code base via tools, et cetera, you know, access to PRs and the commits, they're going to be able to do that. Are they quite at the stage of being able to find a whole new class of vulnerability that is completely undiscovered and not prompt and patterned in itself? I don't know yet. I think we're maybe a little bit off that, but I don't think we're too far away from that.
Yeah, pretty interesting. Kautar, maybe to bring it to you next, I mean, because you think a little bit about the kind of risks around all these technologies, you know, it seems to me, right, like that, like, you're going to use this for security, but also, like, the bad guys will get access to these agents as well. And it seems like very straightforward to be like, I have this vulnerability, find it elsewhere in this code base, is also exactly the kind of same thing you need to do if you were going to sort of harm these systems. Curious about how you see that kind of cat and mouse game playing out. Like, does the defense have the advantage right now? Do you think the offense is eventually going to have the advantage? Kind of just what that balance looks like as these systems become more sophisticated.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Of course, as Big Sleep or other similar systems, they're strengthening defense with AI agents. So they're revolutionizing vulnerability testing, allowing continuous autonomous scanning that adapts to new threats. And this is especially beneficial in complex systems or complex environments, like, for example, cloud infrastructures, where we're doing all these manual monitoring is very inefficient. And security teams could be empowered and act faster on these emerging vulnerabilities and reducing the attack window. However, at the same time, there's also this threat of offensive AI. So AI-driven security tools can also be a weapon in the wrong hands. Just as defenders can use AI to preemptively catch vulnerabilities, attackers could also use similar tools to identify exploits at scale. So this creates this potential AI, like you said, arms race in cybersecurity, where the line between defense and offense is very thin.
Yeah, I think what's so interesting about it is it also suggests kind of eventually we're going to see a whole kind of dark criminal ecosystem, which kind of mirrors the kind of one that we have publicly, like that there will be basically like a a criminal Lambda Labs, right? Where you can like kind of run all these agents, you know, completely free and for criminal purposes. And it'll be really interesting to see how that kind of ecosystem evolves, because, you know, people who want to use these agents for bad purposes will sort of need the same infrastructure that, you know, the people doing cybersecurity are engaged in.
Yeah, so I think that's why maybe some ethical and regulatory here challenges are will need to be resolved, you know, with this rapid development of AI-based security. There is this call for frameworks to ensure also responsible users. How do you protect these infrastructures and tools? So government, for example, and government cybersecurity experts, they need to be tasked with creating also ethical guidelines and regulations to balance the benefits of things like Big Sleep with its potential misuse also.
Yeah, let me give you a client perspective on this. We do a lot of work with our clients on cybersecurity. We have a whole security services team within IBM Consulting. It's been doing an exceptional job with clients. We also partner very heavily with our partners like Palo Alto to do a lot of cybersecurity work with them. And we're leveraging generative AI models and AI models quite heavily in that partnership as well. It's a two-way street. It is AI helping drive better security. And as the reverse, how do you secure the AI models themselves, right? If you look at the three different steps that our clients go through, they're securing the actual data that went into the models, securing the model itself from cyber attacks, and then the usage itself, how do you prevent misuse of the model when it's in production, right? So there's across all these three different buckets, we've done quite a bit of work in creating AI models that prevent and detect and can counter the serial attacks and things of that nature. We had recently released our Granite series of models, Granite 3.0. There are a lot of public benchmarks, and we have some private IBM benchmarks as well, where every model that we are putting into production, we have the ability to go test them across all these different attack patterns and stuff, right? And if you look at that small class of models, which are roughly 2 to 8 billion parameter models, we do a really good job at across all those different 7, 8 different criteria. The Granite model scored higher than, say, the Llama and the Mistral and a few other models as well. Then on securing the actual usage, every time you're talking to a model and you're bringing data out for the model, both input and outputs get filtered. So I'm much more confident in 2024 November when we put models in production, there are enough safety guardrails from IBM and other ecosystem partners that we can start to address these fairly well.
Yeah, that's great. And there's one subtlety here that I think is worth diving a little bit more into, Shobhit, if you want to speak to it, is, you know, with Big Sleep, you're basically having like an agent, like an AI model, examine sort of traditional, if you will, software code. And it strikes me that there's a whole separate set of questions about how you could use models to analyze the security of models, right?
Yes.
Because I think obviously where all this goes is that, like, once you do security on agents, it's the security of your security agent that becomes important. I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about like how the thinking around that is evolving, because it feels like the pattern matching of, oh, here's a vulnerability in code that we're finding elsewhere looks a little bit different from how you might use a model to evaluate the security or safety of a model.
Yes, and I've been really excited about the work that collectively the AI community has done in this space. Outside of Google, we've had some amazing work done by NVIDIA, Meta, IBM Research on creating these models that can detect vulnerabilities, right? So we do that at scale. There's a pattern recognition on the logs that's coming out. There is security vulnerability on what are the corner cases. You can now start to create infinite possible combinations of how you could break a particular model, and you can stress test them in real time, right? So I think we are doing a good job as a community on sharing those techniques as well. A lot of the work in the space has been very open source. So you can start to compare different models, different benchmarks, private and public, that people are leveraging to test these vulnerabilities of software code. I think over time, there was a recent paper that came on comparing even the LLM judge. How do you judge the LLM judge, right? So there's a lot of this, like, starts to get thinking about very meta and this AI, this monitoring AI. But I think we are just moving the bar of what does a human do versus what does an AI do? So if you think about the way we employ people into our organizations, we would have somebody who's a graduate from an amazing school with multiple degrees, just like a really nice LLM. And then we're giving them some few short learnings, some examples during training, saying that here's how we do this thing in our company. Then you'll give them access to all the other vulnerabilities and all the other things, right? They are in real time reading up on a new vulnerability that happens in a particular environment, and then trying to think how will that impact their own code. So we're starting to crunch through some of those steps that a human would have done. And if you think about this as bring a new graduate hire from an institution like MIT or Stanford into your organization for cybersecurity, that's the exact same pattern that we are following with LLMs as well.
Yeah, that kind of human metaphor of how we train cybersecurity experts and applying that to the model is interesting. And I think lands on maybe the final question I had for this segment, which is, Chris, if I can ask you to make another wild prediction for this episode, is... You know, it feels like the threshold, the badge of honor, if you're a security person, is like you disclosed a really novel kind of exploit at DEF CON. And I guess I'm kind of curious if like you think that like agents will eventually pull that off. And if so, you have an over-under on like the year. Is it 2027 when we're going to have a billion engineers, or is how far off is that?
In 2028, this is my prediction, AI agents will reveal the first human vulnerability in code. And therefore, they will say, this person here is a human vulnerability and they're doing bad things. So that's my prediction, 2028. It's going to be the other way around. AI agents predicting human vulnerabilities.
Interesting. Yeah, I would love if the agent finds out a way, like, this is the new method for social engineering, would be actually in some ways like very perfect.
I think also what's going to be interesting is as AI finds our security flaws faster than ever, the real question is, who's quicker, defenders patching them or attackers ready to exploit them?
No, that'd be really funny to see. And the human vulnerability part, Chris, you just mentioned, we're doing this for one of the big Latin American banks right now, where we are leveraging some social engineering techniques and stuff. The emails that you create for social engineering attacks, it just looks so plausible, right? LLMs are really good at creating convincing content, and you can trick and like the whole like clickbaiting people to go into a rabbit hole, that's working out really well. But it's really nice. Some of our clients are saying that, hey, I'm not quite sure about putting AI in production. Our security teams won't give us the green check. Let's go pilot LLMs for security team first. If they're convinced and they put it in production, then they don't have an excuse to bottleneck the rest of the organization. It's been a good good method working with lawyers and cybersecurity teams in these large organizations.
Yeah, it's going to be so hard when you like try to log into work and it's like, you've been locked out because you're just too gullible. you're like, we've assessed that you can't make it here. It's just like, okay. So, it's coming. 2028, you heard it here first. For our final segment, I want to talk a little bit about Search GPT. So it goes without saying that OpenAI is the heavy in the industry, the big leader. Everybody's been waiting on their features and what they release. And one thing that everybody's been waiting on for a long time is for them to finally get into the search space. And long anticipated, but it finally launched. And now OpenAI now has a Search GPT feature. And this enters a market that's been kind of dominated and competed over by, you know, companies like Perplexity. And of course, you know, Google through Gemini really wants to get into this space as well. And so this is a big move, right? The big industry leader has finally kind of put its marker down for what it wants to do in search. And I know, Shobit, you looked into this. You know, the question I always come to it is like, does this mean that Perplexity is doomed? Like, is everybody doomed now that OpenAI is in the space? And kind of curious about what you think the effect on the market's going to look like.
So I recently posted on LinkedIn saying that I've had access to GPT search for a while. I pay for a whole, I'm very gullible in paying $20 a month to try out all kinds of AI. So I've been a paid subscriber for a while and I was lucky enough to get access to it. I was comparing it, the closest competitor would be something like Gemini Search, right? And then it'll be things like Perplexity, right? So I think if I did a side-by-side comparison, I have like 13 different areas of topics that I compared GPT Search versus Google Gemini. And overall, I don't think I'm going to be switching my search from Perplexity and Google and Gemini over to GPT Search quite yet. And there are a few things that I found when I was comparing them one by one. Just to summarize this, I have a whole article giving you visual side-by-sides. But Google generally is a lot more visual. They've learned from years of UX what's the best way to represent the information for the user, right? So for example, if you're suggesting restaurants, if I ask GPT Search to find restaurants in a particular location versus Google Gemini understands that it's logical to put a map and pinpoint all the restaurants in the response that I'm giving you, right? So it understands the right UX and people would want to go interact with the graphic and see which one is closest and so on and so forth, right? Similarly, if you're talking about weather, it makes sense. And for the last few years, Google has had a really nice card on the very top and tells you exactly what I'm looking for, right? The one thing that that GPT needs to address is they have a proliferation of different capabilities. They're not quite combined into a single UI yet, So as an example, when I switch over to web search, I lose the ability to upload any content. I can't give in any attachments. I can't use any function calling, things of that nature that I'm very used to when I'm using my O1 previews or my 4.0s, right? Versus in the Gemini world, Google Gemini, they figure out what I'm looking for, right? So the simplest example would be if I'm standing in front of a monument or some place, some landmark, I take a picture. I said, can you find me restaurants around this? Right now, obviously, Google Gemini will identify the place, very high accuracy. It'll give me nice recommendations and it'll help me fine tune it. ChatGPT's GPT search cannot take attachment. So it can't take any itinerary. It can't do things like if I give you a document and say, here are the people that I'm looking for, go on LinkedIn and scrape something for them. It can't act. It doesn't have access to function calling. I can't give you documents, right? So there's certain things that are like absolutely missing. On the GPT side, I think that the last piece that is going for Gemini, which is still why I favor Gemini Google, is the connection to your personal data. I've been a big Google, like my email address is Shobhit at Gmail. I got that like when they were starting, the very, very beginning, right? So all my data, my photos, my calendars and stuff like that are inside of Gmail. So when I ask about, hey, can I find restaurants near the hotel I'm staying in Mexico, it'll be able to go find that really quick. It's very, very personalized. It can go search with my permission, of course. It can go and look into my emails and things of that nature. That has a huge value add to me.
Yeah, that's so interesting is basically that, you know, I think maybe one way of thinking about this competition is like how much is search about like the form of the results versus like the substance of the results, right? Which is kind of showing what you're saying is like, oh, when you ask for a restaurant, it's great to have like the map and the pins and like all the stuff that Google has indexed, even though the response might be like less conversationally well-flavored than like what you might get out of Perplexity or something like that.
Just to counter maybe some of the arguments that Shobhit mentioned, of course, having that personalization is so important, having access to all of that. And I think Google has perfected many of these features given its long history with search. But don't you see as GPT is acquiring also more multimodality features, and as more people are using ChatGPT or SearchGPT, that personalization will come along. You know, they'll acquire more personal data. They can customize also things. So I think it's just maybe a catch-up game here. One thing also that I find nice in SearchGPT that I still don't see in Google search is that interactive nature. The way they basically, it's more conversational search. So unlike traditional search where they give you like a bunch of links that you have to click through, this is making search more intuitive, particularly for complex queries or ongoing projects. Users might not longer need to click through a list of links as the model delivers synthesized responses.
So Carter, I will push back on that a bit, if I may. I think it's unfair, it's apples to oranges if you're comparing GPT search with the classic Google search. The right comparison would be Gemini search with Google, right? So Google's Gemini is multimodal. Like I said earlier, I can take pictures and things of that nature. It is personalized. You can tap into your Google, your Gmails and stuff if needed. I can take images and so on and so forth, right? So Google understands, acknowledges that the blue link world is dying. Their Gemini Google search, I think, is an incredible product. It works really, really well, and they're trying their best to make sure that within the conservative boundaries of what they can do, being such a large company, personalizing, hyper-personalizing, and multimodality and things of that nature, looking at very, very long videos and summarizing it, like things like that, I think they have a very good moat. But the true comparison is not Google search, blue links with GPT search. Like a lot of people in media are comparing the two together, and I feel that it's unfair to Google.
I agree with you. It's not a fair comparison, yes. And I think the question here, are we moving towards this one model to rule them all scenario for search? Or it's going to be a competition. So,
but we always had one more model to rule them all with Google, like, because they had such a massive 95% plus market, right? So I think people
Is that shifting to the Google's Gemini or OpenAI right now will have a place as it's also improving its search capabilities?
So I think OpenAI is going to win this one out, but maybe not for the reasons you think. And so my experience with ChatGPT with search in this case is it works as a true extension to the conversation I was having anyway. So I was having a good, so maybe I'm looking at a particular paper on something, I want something updated. Before, without access to the internet there, it's only going to come back with a limited amount of information, right? With ChatGPT with search, it extends out, it takes its knowledge plus the knowledge that it's got from the internet and then starts to give me back better answers. And for me, that is the game-changing part. And I just found myself using ChatGPT with search more naturally than I did before. So rather than reaching out for Google to go answer that question and then mess around, I'm just doing it within the conversation. Now, if I then bring that in with the O1 capabilities as that starts to get released, and then as they start to combine the modalities, the fact is, OpenAI has been leading on the modalities on this for a while. They're ahead of the game with the O1 models, et cetera, making it more agentic. When they bring all that together, I think Google's got a lot of work to do there. Are they going to go after true search, et cetera? No, but if this is a comparison between Gemini and the O1 models with search capabilities and tools, as it stands today, I think OpenAI is winning that one. And I feel that today from the experience I'm having. And the fact is, there are millions of people using ChatGPT today, and there's maybe 12 people in Showbit that's using Gemini to search today.
Wow.
So I think that's my feeling.
Yeah, I think there's a very interesting question here a little bit about, like, it's a debate over what we think the commodity asset is and what do we think is the irreplaceable asset or the hard to duplicate apps asset. I think Showbit, if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but Showbit, your position seems to be all of this data, all of this kind of incumbent advantage is the hard to replace thing. And I think what Chris is saying is like, well, actually getting the data is not the hard part. It's this initial additional analysis layer, which is going to be the really unique differentiator. I don't know, maybe that's the right way.
There's no doubt that Google is under a lot of pressure. Perplexity has just shown how well they work. And like, I'm a pro user for a very long time with Perplexity. Amazing work, right? So I think, generally speaking, yes, they have a lot of pressure on getting this right. It's a $100 billion problem for them to solve. So they're putting everything that they can behind it, right? So they had to make sure that they nail the conversational search part and more personalized. I think the things that are going in favor of Google are the fact that they have the world's data to train on in YouTube and search, and they have like decades of how people, the patterns that people follow to get to the right answer when they're planning a trip, things of that nature. They do have a lot that they can tap into that other competitors like OpenAI do not have access to today. Right. So over time, they'll try to catch up with each other. Google will always have a lot of fire behind them to go fix this, to get this the right way. But I'm just the fact that my personal data is accessible to Google, I think that may change at some point. But in the current state, it is more relevant for me to have an answer that's hyper-personalized to me and the way I do things, right? The fact that I'm asking you to set an itinerary in Italy, it should know that I'm landing at 2 p.m. and not start my itinerary at 6 a.m. Right? So that fundamental part of me having to tell a model, say, guys, just understand what is important to me first. And you know that the airport is X hours away. So take all of that information into consideration. And I'm thinking about this from a very enterprise perspective as well, right? For us, our clients are more focused on, I have all this repository of manufacturing documents and warranty documents and stuff like that. And then I have all of the other data sets. I need to be able to search against those with high accuracy. And the same experience I'm getting with ChatGPT or a search or with Gemini, I need to bring that into my employees to get unlock the value. And it's really nice to see that Meta is starting to get into this game as well. There's a lot of rumor over the week about Meta coming up with its own search, because now they're incrementally making progress towards that space as well. So I'm really excited about the future of what happens with getting information to Showbit in the moment that I need, that's hyper-personalized to the way I consume information and what's in my emails, things of that nature.
And I agree with that, Showbit, but you know what? I don't want Google having exclusive access to my information, right? Do you know what I actually want? An open ecosystem and marketplace where I can plug into the agents, here, go access to my Gmail, go access to this, etc. And as opposed to going, well, Google's already got this information and it can train its models and do whatever it wants with my 100%. Data and nobody else can play in the system. So open ecosystem is where I am. So yes, I agree, but it's got to be open.
Yeah, there is this potential for a centralized AI search model to emerge, potentially monopolizing search You know, while this could bring, you know, consistency and ease of use, it also risks creating, you know, this information bottleneck. So I definitely agree with Chris that having an open system would be better, because if one model provides more search answers, it might centralize information flow, reduce diversity in information sources, and also shape public knowledge in ways we really don't yet understand.
Great. Well, that's all the time we have for today. It's great, Shobha, that you mentioned that meta thing, because that was the other part I wanted to get into. So we will definitely have that on a future episode of Mixture of Experts. But unfortunately, we are out of time today. So thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. Shobha, Kautar, Chris, thanks as always. Appreciate you joining us.